Hello and welcome to the Veterinary Secrets Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Jones and this is episode 20. In today's podcast, we're going to be covering a variety of pet health topics. Liver disease is very common. On this podcast, you're going to learn how to naturally treat it. There are many new emerging veterinary therapies, including cutting-edge stem cell cure. Lastly, we're going to explore a big question that I personally wrestle with. Can we justify killing animals for food? Now Veterinary Secrets is on iTunes. Go to iTunes and search for Veterinary Secrets. We're also on Stitcher. You can download the Stitcher app and search for Veterinary Secrets or go to stitcher.com/podcast/veterinary-secrets. I would definitely appreciate it if you would subscribe to my podcast and leave a review. You can do so on iTunes or Stitcher. Questions or comments, feel free to post a comment on my blog at veterinarysecrets.com/blog, or you can send me an email, and that's at podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. Let's get right into today's podcast, how to naturally treat liver disease. One of the largest and most important organs is your dog's liver. It has a number of functions such as digestion, detoxification, sugar storage, breaking down red blood cells, and hormone production. It's found under the rib cage, encircling the stomach, and tucked up next to the diaphragm. And in this podcast, you're going to learn the more common causes of canine liver disease, along with the common symptoms to recognize in your dog. I will discuss the more steps in diagnosis of liver disease and the large number of holistic options that are available if your dog is to be diagnosed with canine liver disease. There are numerous things that can cause liver disease, ranging from tumors to infections. Dogs commonly eat compost, in which there is often a toxin that can cause acute liver disease, and this happened to my own dog. Your pet can get a viral infection affecting the liver, known as hepatitis. Young dogs can have liver disease as a result of a liver shunt, or certain breeds can acquire liver disease due to a copper storage deficiency, Bedlington Terriers, Westies, Keyhounds, and Dalmatians. Common veterinary medications, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, can damage the liver and result in signs of liver disease. Fortunately, the liver can do a wonderful job of regenerating liver cells and can often heal itself with supportive care and supplements. The signs of liver disease are many and varied. They are similar to many other canine diseases. In the early stages, there are often no specific symptoms, and the first signs can be very non-specific. Some of the more common signs to start with are eating. Your pet's appetite is lowered. Some dogs are depressed, are lethargic, and are classified as ADR. That's a veterinary term for ain't doing right. As the disease progresses, there may be vomiting or diarrhea. Many dogs show signs of increased drinking and urinating more than normal. Due to the lower protein levels in the blood, it's a specific type of protein called albumin, which is produced from the liver, you may see fluid retention, which can show up as a swollen belly. A classic symptom is jaundice. The white area around the eyes and the gums may be yellowish. You can also sometimes see it just in the inside of the ear. A few uncommon signs include neurologic disease, which can show up as circling, head pressing, wobbling or ataxia and seizures, and hepatocutaneous syndrome is a type of skin disease which can show up as thickened crusted foot pads, itchiness, redness between the toes. Canine liver disease is diagnosed with an initial physical exam along with a detailed history, which may reveal some of the classic symptoms such as jaundice. Your veterinarian will then suggest a basic blood panel, which may reveal many changes suggesting liver disease. Specific things you can see elevated include enzymes, ALT-FOS, ALT, GGT, bilirubin. Many dogs are anemic, so they have low red blood cell counts, and most have low protein levels, especially low albumin, which is produced by the liver. Urine changes often show up as bilirubin in the urine and brownish, yellowish urine. First, if you suspect that your dog has liver disease, the first step is to confirm what type of liver disease your pet has. Your veterinarian can perform some of the above-specific diagnostic tests, as there are so many possibilities. Adequate nutrition is key to help the liver heal. Offer your dog his favorite food. In some cases, spicing it up with garlic and warming it up in a microwave will encourage eating. Many holistic veterinarians advise a natural, moderate protein, moderate carbohydrate diet. Your veterinarian may advise a specific veterinary diet. Regardless, the most important thing of all the things I'm going to discuss is that it's a food that your dog likes and wants to eat. The composition of the food is not near as critical as getting your pet to eat. Of all the alternative options, milk thistle is the most important solution in helping any ailing liver. It's a herb, the active ingredient called silymarin, and it has wonderful protective effects on the liver. liver. It helps improve liver function, helps treat liver inflammation, toxin-induced liver disease, and end-stage liver failure, known as cirrhosis. The dose of the dried herb is 100 milligrams per 10 pounds of body weight daily. It's available at most pharmacies, and I've had wonderful success using this herb. S-adenethylmethionine, also known as SAMI, S-A-M, lowercase e, is a supplement and a potent antioxidant shown to be very effective in people and pets with chronic liver disease. The tablets are available at health food stores, dosing it at 800 milligrams for 40 pounds of body weight daily. Antioxidant vitamins work in conjunction with SAMI to decrease liver cell damage and help the liver regenerate. Vitamin E and vitamin C are the two most common ones used, dosing it at 400 international units for 40 pounds of body weight daily of vitamin E and 250 milligrams for 40 pounds of body weight daily of vitamin C. Turmeric gives curry its flavor and yellow color, and it has been used in anti-inflammatory to treat digestive and liver problems, skin diseases, and wounds, while also being a powerful antioxidant. Antioxidants are working because they help fight free radicals and may reduce or even prevent some of the damage that they cause, such as damaging the liver. The dose of the dried herb is 100 milligrams per 10 pounds of body weight daily. It can also be given as a tincture, 2 drops per 10 pounds daily. The big point, if you can use turmeric, I want you to use curcumin, and that's the 95% curcuminoids, and those are available at most natural pharmacies now, many conventional ones now too. But you need to be looking at that dose, 100 milligrams per 10 pounds daily. Many cases of liver disease are believed to be secondary to the immune system attacking the liver and bile duct, known as autoimmune. There are a number of supplements that can be helpful in normalizing the immune system, but there are particular ones that may be beneficial for the liver. These are the flavonoids, which are compounds in a class of their own. They compose the thousands of structures that give the bright color to fruits and vegetables. These include the flavonones, apigenin, isoflavonones, and flavanols, quercetin. You can purchase a mixed bioflavonoid product that contains polyphenols, but in particular EGCG, which is the specific flavonoid isolated from green tea. The dose would be for a 10-pound dog is 250 milligrams daily. Homeopathic remedies are used to supplement veterinary care and additional remedies. Often our dogs are very weak when they have liver disease, so you can begin with one of the homeopathics. They're great ones to start with. Cardis is produced from milk thistle. Some dogs may vomit the milk thistle herbal capsules, so this really is a great option. The dose being 130c capsule for 20 pounds twice daily. Liver disease in dogs is one of the more common veterinary diagnoses, and now you should be able to recognize the more common symptoms, anorexia, weight loss, vomiting, distended abdomen, and jaundice. Causes are varied, but with many dogs having acute damage by ingesting some type of toxin or reacting to a prescribed veterinary medication. There are numerous holistic options to treat canine liver disease, ranging from the herb milk thistle to flavonoids, including green tea. Cutting-edge stem cell cures. The UC Davis Veterinary Institute of Regenerative Cures is working to develop new therapies for both humans and animals. It's housed at the Veterinary School at UC Davis, and they're working on leading-edge stem cell research and therapy by developing and then integrating regenerative medical discoveries into clinical practice. It's founded this year, 2015, after more than 7 years of program building and basic research. They've developed teams of basic researchers, clinicians, students, and technical staff to translate the discoveries into treating specific disease targets. The program focuses primarily on developing and conducting relevant clinical trials in natural occurring diseases of animals, and then translating those research findings into clinical practice. One veterinarian there said that we convert all that we learn in the lab into the clinical practice. We look at how the stem cells work in the lab and then how the cells work with cells within the body, the immune system, and how these cells work in the context of inflammation and different types of clinical lesions. We then try to identify diseases that have similar immune cell and inflammation profiles that we hope respond to stem cell treatment. We're most successful when we integrate our work with functional, engaged clinical teams to explore stem cell therapy further into the clinical setting to help cure diseases. They're trying to make that big link. So here are some specific diseases that we're working on. Their neurologic disease team is working on spinal cord injury and spina bifida in dogs and equine neurological disease. One member of the team is a clinician and is a board certified in equine medicine and neurology. Another is a professor of surgery and radiology. The ophthalmology team is working on KCS, called dry eye, in dogs, and recurrent uveitis or inflammation of the cornea in horses. The inflammatory disease team works on feline oral inflammation. That's cats with this chronic type of serious mouth disease, gingivostomatitis, and a group is studying the use of stem cells for inflammatory bowel disease in dogs. One member of this team is a staff veterinarian for pathology, microbiology, and immunology department. The orthopedic group is working with stem cells as potential treatment for problems with tendons, ligaments, joint lesions, and lesions of the feet and hooves of horses. The dentistry and oral surgery team looks at jaw bone regeneration by using a tissue engineering approach. This collaborative team includes tissue engineers from the biomedical engineering department. So let's just look into some specific diseases. And there's bigger ones in particular, but there's a couple big ones. So let's look at feline disease. The disease which has received the most attention is feline chronic gingivostomatitis. So that you get severe inflammation of the gums. It affects about 1% of cats in clinical practice. It's painful, severe, chronic inflammatory lesion of the cat's gingiva, that's the tissue around the teeth, and the moist tissue that lines its oral cavity. Cats with the disease chronically salivate, don't eat properly due to the pain of oral inflammation, and lose weight. There's no ideal treatment for this disease. The current protocol is to extract all the teeth. If the cat doesn't respond to this therapy, it will then have to undergo lifelong therapy with steroids and antibiotics. Stem cells have been effective in treating this disease, with results that vary from clinical cure to substantial improvement in about 70% of these patients. We treat these cats with two doses of IV stem cells. We've noticed that the stem cell therapy is very potent anti-inflammatory, so we get resolution of the oral inflammation. Along with that, we see concomitant changes in the inflammatory biomarkers in the blood. We're working to optimize the stem cell protocol. We think the stem cells are modulating the immune response, altering T cell activation. The work in the lab focuses on how stem cells interact with the type of lymphocyte called T lymphocytes, and how they alter T cell function and phenotype. Our work with cats suffering from gingivostomatitis has been an excellent model of how stem cells work and is a success story regarding the stem cell therapy. So canine disease. Currently underway, there are clinical investigations of the use of stem cells in inflammatory bowel disease, spinal cord injury, and keratoconjunctivitis, SCEC, or KCS, which is dry eye in dogs. They're recruiting dogs with spinal cord injury that have no deep pain perception. That serious sort of end-stage spinal cord injury, where it's thought even surgery is no benefit. As part of the study, the dogs will undergo surgery and concurrent stem cell therapy embedded in a gel matrix at the site of the lesion. The objective is to improve the outcome of these patients with severe disease. Assessment will include gait analysis over time and physiologic parameters, as well as complete neurologic examinations to determine safety and efficacy of the stem cell therapy to treat spinal cord injury in dogs. Our goal is to enroll dogs for stem cell therapy that have fairly poor prognosis with the surgery alone, with the hope that the stem cells and their ability to assist in neural repair will promote recovery. Equine disease. For equine patients with neurologic disease, the team will inject stem cells intrathecally or into the spinal cord. We're going to track the cells as we have a stem cell imaging team that labels stem cells and see where they go. We'll start as we normally do with a safety study in normal horses. After that, the team will be looking at using stem cells for the chronic inflammatory sequelae of equine protozoal encephalomyelitis. So that's sort of inflammation in that area of the brain that's protozoal induced, as well as another type of neurologic disease called Wobbler syndrome. These guys are very weak. It's called cervical vertebral instability, cervical spondylomyelopathy, that's degeneration in that area of the spinal cord and the cervix, and cervical vertebral malformation. Those are all neurologic type diseases that are very difficult to treat. The idea behind the use of therapy for these diseases is that these stem cells have a basic neuroregenerative and neuroprotective function. Once we're assured of safety, we'll enroll a few of these animals with either of these equine neurologic diseases. Animals tend to be enrolled are those individuals that don't have a lot of options, either because they have severe disease, might be considered unsafe, or otherwise they're going to be euthanized. We'll begin with such individuals and we'll check for safety and efficacy. Then we'll move to stem cell therapy to clinoid animals with more moderate neurologic disease. The last section of the podcast is a question that I said I also wrestle with. You know, can we justify killing animals for food? And what this is, it's a section, there's four different philosophers were asked this very question. Is it right to kill animals for food? And if it's wrong, how wrong is it? Could and should Western society ever change its views? So the first one is Peter Singer, who says that our future selves will consider meat eating to be barbaric. He's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University and the author of Animal Liberation. You could say that if you kill a cow, you're depriving it of its right of existence, which also could have been had a happy, good existence. So why deprive it of that because you want to eat some meat when you've got other healthy, nutritious, delicious things that you could also eat. The counter argument is if this cow would not have existed, if we had not planned in advance that at some point we would kill it and we would sell the meat, because obviously it costs something to rear a cow, and we can only meet that cost if we're going to kill it. So in a sense, the cow could thank us for their existence. At least she has some existence rather than that. If a cow is killed, that will make it possible for another cow to come into existence, who will have a good life. And if the first cow were not killed, it would not be possible for that cow to come into existence. So yes, this cow standing in front of us will lose the rest of her life, but that loss is replaced by bringing the other cow into existence. The other cow will also have to will also have that happy life. In theory, other things are being equal. He says, I don't buy the argument. I say in theory because I think it's very hard to produce circumstances where that actually occurs and there aren't other undesirable effects. Given the animals in our food supply are mostly cattle and sheep and they're major producers of greenhouse gases, I think on balance, it would be better if they didn't exist. I think we'll come to view eating meat in the way we now look back in the Roman games, having crowds of enthusiastic people cheering as the lions as they slaughter the Christians or gladiators fighting each other to death. The last time I intentionally ate meat was 1971. I grew up eating a lot of meat in Australia and I liked it, but I really haven't missed it for a long time. Elizabeth Harmon, a moral mistake, but not morally wrong. She's an associate professor of philosophy and human values at Princeton. The kind of moral picture that I would urge is one in which we think about whether we can justify our treatment of individuals. If you're going to do something terrible to a particular morally significant individual, how can that be justified? She claims that animals have moral status and animal suffering matters, but it's a harm to do something that counts morally. Killing an animal harms the animal. We're actively doing something that deprives it of its future life. One way of thinking about how we justify an action is what could you say to one that you're harming. It works very well with people, works less with cows who can't understand justifications. But we can imagine someone who is representative of the cow, and what would you say to the cow's representative to justify your treatment of it? If you kill one cow and then you create another cow, that doesn't justify killing the one cow at all, in my view. Claims that I think meat production is morally wrong, and I think that eating meat is a moral mistake, but not morally wrong. If you buy or eat meat, then you're doing something that plays some kind of causal role in meat production. But it's a very removed causal role, so it's not plausible that any particular animal suffering depends on whether you make a particular purchase. So in that way, you don't have any particular bit of animal suffering or death in your head for that instance of meat eating. What you're doing is participating in the continuation of meat production, and you're also failing to participate in the vegetarian movement, which I think is really a good moral thing that's happened. Still, who eat meat, I'm really torn about how I feel about it. Jeff McMahon. Cows have a moral interest in continuing to live. He's a White's professor of moral philosophy at the University of Oxford. He says that if you didn't kill the cow, you could go on living and have a life that would be good for it. That's part of why it would be wrong for me to kill you. It would be depriving you of the good experiences that you would have if you didn't. An animal has an interest in living to have its next meal as well. You don't have to think about humans in exactly the same way that you think about cows. We've got to explain why do you think it's permissible to do that to an animal? What do you think it would be permissible to do not be to do to a human being? In the case of people, their suffering matters, but their happiness also matters. The same thing should be true with case in animals. Do you think it's permissible to kill a cow and eat it if it's had a life that's been good and it's killed painlessly? If people could get adequate nutrition otherwise, then I think yes. If they couldn't get it, in a society like contemporary America or Great Britain, my inclination is to say no. It's not clear at all that the interest that people have in killing and eating the cow outweighs the interest that the cow has in continuing to live. That's because the flesh of the cow is going to provide a certain amount of additional pleasure for people who eat it. When we do the cost-benefit analysis here, we shouldn't weigh all the pleasure that people get from eating a meal with a cow's meat. We should weigh just the difference in pleasure that they would get from eating the cow and eating some meal that they didn't have meat in it. My own view is that in most cases, it's not very much. I don't feel as a vegetarian that I'm in any way deprived. And the last philosopher is Gary Comstock. He's a professor of philosophy at North Carolina. He says, in killing an animal, we deprive it of its ability to have a future and to satisfy its desires. So I'm very interested in whether cattle look forward. I think they do. An interesting experiment was done by Donald Broom and colleagues at Cambridge a few years ago with heifers, one-year-old cows, which seemed to show that not only can they learn, but they also take satisfaction in knowing that they're learning. In the first control group, heifers learned to hit a button that let them into a long long chute, the end of which was a reward. They knew which button to push, but had no control over when the gate would open. They were interested to get to the end of the chute, but otherwise their behavior was unremarkable. A second group of heifers had control over when the gate would open. As they learned which buttons to push to open the gate, they got better at pushing the right button, and the gate opened faster, so they got the reward more. The second group of heifers saw their own improvements in performance. They jumped and kicked and galloped down to get the reward, behaviors that suggest strongly that they not only anticipated pleasure of the reward coming, but were also taking pleasure in their own role in making it happen. It seems they were very aware of, perhaps even proud of, their accomplishment. There is a danger in anthropomorphizing of animals, of overinterpreting their behavior, but these are controlled experiments. They're not my intuitions of what I think is going on in the cattle's mind. There's also anatomical evidence. If you look at the brains and neural pathways in cattle and compare them to humans, there's massive similarities. The amygdala, the cerebellum, the thalamus, which are involved in processing pain in us, are all found in cattle. People used to justify eating meat for biologic reasons where omnivores or incisors are designed to eat meat. This is a natural thing for us to do. The problem is there's so many natural things that are not right for us to do, and the biological features are irrelevant to the questions of how we ought to live our lives. Evidence seems to be building that the shoe's on the other foot now. For those that want to kill animals and eat them to justify their view, it shouldn't be the other way around. So thank you for listening to this edition of the podcast. I'm hoping it's given you some food for thought as far as, one, should you be eating animals? Is that the right thing to do? God, great questions. And I encourage you just to put some thought into it, period. Secondly, I hope you got some good information around naturally treating liver disease, if your dog has ever have liver disease. We've got some good stuff there. And you listen intently to the section on stem cell therapy. There's some wonderful new potential treatments for it. So if you were to have a dog that has serious neurologic disease, I really want you to be looking at stem cell therapy. For a cat that's got horrible stomatitis, so difficult to treat. Once again, thanks for listening. My name is Dr. Andrew Jones. Any questions? For sure, you can post a comment on my blog at veterinarysecrets.com/blog, or you can send me an email. That's at podcast@veterinarysecrets.com.